Family groups are a fellowship of relatives and friends of alcoholics who share their experience, strength, and hope in order to solve their common problems. We believe alcoholism is a family illness and that changed attitudes can aid recovery. Al-Anon is not allied with any sect, denomination, political entity, organization, or institution, does not engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any cause. There are no dues for membership. Al-Anon is self-supporting through its own voluntary contributions. Al-Anon has but one purpose, to help families of alcoholics. We do this by practicing the 12 steps, by welcoming and giving comfort to families of alcoholics, and by giving understanding and encouragement to the alcoholic. I'm Barbara Knickerbocker, and I am real glad to be here, and I am so glad to see all of you. Monday, we had 40 reservations, and we got out and got the word out, and this is a terrific turnout for the first annual Heritage Day. We're thrilled to death. I think everyone deserves a hand. We have some special guests with us today. We asked Daisy, who is still an active Al-Anon member, if she could contact some of the Al-Anons that had been in the program over 20 years ago. And she did come up with some for us, and they're here today as our guests. And if you can, I would like for you to rise when I call your name. And if you could, please hold your applause until the end. Lucille. Bernice. Lois. Eleanor. Claire. Daisy. Nancy. Is Nancy here? Yeah. Catherine. And Marie. We are so glad to have you here. You know, none of us would have been here if they hadn't been there. So we're just real glad y'all could be with us today. I'd like to introduce the head table. I have Dean M. We're going to use full names. We're all friends here. Dean Martinez is District 14 DR. Faye Guidry, District 9 DR. Marna Villon is our delegate to the World Service Conference in New York, and she leaves tomorrow to go to the conference. On the far left end here is Pat DeSalle. Pat is the incoming chairman of the Al-Anon office, the Information Service office. Where's Gail? She slipped out. Gail Flowers is our chairman of the area World our area assembly. There she is, coming in the door. And this next lady I met about 3.5 years ago in Monroe. She spoke. And we got there early, and I went to the hospitality room, because isn't that what you do when you get to a conference? You go to the hospitality room to mingle. And there's this woman walked in, and she immediately took over. And she was talking Al-Anon like she really knew what she's talking about. And I'm thinking, who is this person, you know? And I sat there listening to her, and I was absolutely enthralled, because she knew about pieces of literature that had been written when they were first written, who wrote them, and how it was done. She has a marvelous story. She is a wonderful person, and I'm thrilled to death to have her here with us today. I'd like to introduce Arbutus O.N. from Brownwood, Texas. Arbutus.
Thank you very much, Barbara. My name is Arbutus O'Neill, and it is by the grace of God that I belong to the Al-Anon family groups. I'm delighted with our 20-year people. I'll shoot you down in a moment. I am powerless over alcohol, and because of this program, I can make this admission now without feeling guilty. My life is unmanageable without the daily practice of the principles of the program that was given to us by a bunch of ex-drunks who found sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to believe that the families of the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous were convinced by the miracle of sobriety that this program would work for everyone. And it was because of this conviction that the Al-Anon family groups, and a little later the Alateen groups, grew to reach all over the world and have shown astounding results. We subscribe to the concept that alcoholism is a family disease. And I'm very much afraid that we sometimes get so carried away with telling people how sick we got that we forget to say that we have a program for family recovery. And that's why I'm so delighted with this gathering here this afternoon. These get-togethers that we have, sometimes we call them conventions, roundups, jamborees, anniversaries, whatever. These are what I call showcases of recovery. I haven't seen Barbara for 3 years, as she told you, and some of the other people I haven't seen for longer than that. And when we get together on these special occasions, we can see recovery. By the same token, sometimes we can see regression, and we can catch up these people and get them back on the program. So it's very important that we have these special occasions, and I'm very, very grateful to be a part of your first Heritage Anniversary. I didn't know what you were calling it until I saw this little program, and I'm delighted with it. Because we have a fabulous heritage. We have a heritage that is given to no people on earth. Because we love someone who has alcoholism. And that at one time was a very stigmatized condition, and we hung our head in shame and apologized for being alive. And I'm glad that now we can look up and square our shoulders and not be ashamed of ourselves or of anyone else anymore. I want to know if there's some AAs here so I can relax. Oh, good, good. It makes little, or it's rather ridiculous for me to talk to a bunch of Al-Anon people without AA folk here. Because most AA people know more, or more, most Al-Anon people know more about this program than I'll ever know. So I always feel more comfortable when I know there's some AA folk around. I'm called a long-timer in the Al-Anon family groups. And that isn't very important unless you're a long-timer. And do you new people want me to tell you how to get to be a long-timer? Okay. You just continue to come to meetings and try to stay alive, and you'll become a long-timer. That's all it amounts to. No big secret. It's been my great privilege and joy to talk to a lot of people in a lot of places. And I've learned a lot about people. I've learned that people are all alike. Every one of you who are here this afternoon are here for exactly the same reason that I'm here. We were driven here under the cruel lash of alcoholism because we had nowhere else to go. There was a time that I thought that alcoholism was a product of my generation. And why not? We were blamed for everything else. But this, of course, isn't true. Alcoholism is an insidious, progressive illness that prompts the unthinking to make jokes about drunks, but it can leave a family homeless and penniless. Alcoholism is a public cancer that can turn a man or a woman against themselves. Alcoholism is a blight on the history of mankind. The Bible warns against it. Shakespeare diagnosed it. And Tennessee Williams built a prize-winning play around it. But no one, as far as I have been able to learn, seemed to be able to do anything about alcoholism before our lifetime, before our generation. The AAs will be celebrating their 50th anniversary in a short time. And only 50 years ago, there were no help for people who had alcoholism, and certainly there was no help for those of us who loved them. So this is a revolution in the social system of our entire world this knowledge about alcoholism and how to do something about it. Before our lifetime, the priests and ministers were baffled at their inability to do anything about alcoholism, this dreadful malady, this insidious habit. They preached to alcoholics. They prayed over them. They had them sign pledges. And when these things failed, they damned their souls to hell. Men of science in other generations wanted to find a cure for alcoholism. They wanted to find a pill or a vaccine that would stop compulsive drinking. And failing to do this, they said to the young medical students in other generations, "Don't waste your time on these people. They're hopeless." Preachment failed, and there was no cure. So there was only one other thing they knew to do with alcoholics. They must be punished. So we locked them up in jails. The more they drank, the longer we kept them in jail. And the longer we kept them in jail, the more they drank when they were finally released. It became a kind of a vicious cycle. We tried to change the body chemistry of sick people with punishment. And society allowed this to happen. Nay, we insisted on it, to our everlasting shame. But there was one group of people who never quite gave up on alcoholics. These were the families of alcoholics, the people who loved you. We took jobs to feed the children that you were too sick to be responsible for. We picked up your hot checks. We bailed you out of jail. Some of us bought your liquor. We pled with judges. We said, "John's a good man when he's sober." And to complete this ridiculous paradox, we gave you hell every time you got drunk. And society was puzzled at the behavior of the families of alcoholics. We were a far greater puzzlement to society than the alcoholic ever was. And they could not understand why we continued to love and care for alcoholics. There were those people, of course, that thought we were endowed with some special quality that made us better than other people. And they gave us nice shiny halos to wear. They almost killed us with their pity. We don't need pity, we need understanding. And we accepted these halos, I'm sorry to tell you. I put mine on every morning when I put on my lipstick. And my halo had a name. It was called self-righteousness. You know, I've been saying this for a large number of years, and a few years back I discovered something. That word doesn't even taste good. Try it. Self-righteousness. And then there were those people, of course, that thought we were plain fools to live under such circumstances. My mother came in this group. She used to say, "God looks after fools and drunks, and that takes care of Bill and Arbutus." And Mother was right. God did look after us when we didn't have sense enough to look after ourselves. And then there was another very puzzling factor involved, a very significant factor. Now, all of us who are here today know what an alcoholic is. They're sorry, no account, low down, dirty, shiftless people. That's what an alcoholic is. But society discovered that some very talented, brilliant people were alcoholic, and this didn't fit the pattern. And I did a little research about this. My friends in Al-Anon needle me a little bit sometimes. They say, "Arbutus, why on earth do you think you have to give us a history lesson every time you get in front of a microphone?" Well, the fact of the matter is, I can't tell jokes. I always forget the punchline, so I give you a history lesson. And I discovered through my research that Alexander the Great was an alcoholic. He had conquered the whole known civilized world when he was only 33 years old, and he wept because there were no more worlds to conquer. But he could not conquer his desire to drink, and he died prematurely in an alcoholic convulsion. Robert Louis Stevenson was an alcoholic. Now I want to back up a little bit. I want to tell you about, who do I want to tell you about? Robert Louis Stevenson. Who wrote the folk songs that I tell you about? Stephen Foster. Stephen Foster was an alcoholic. And they found Stephen Foster sick unto death on the New York Bowery. And when he was dead, they found in his pockets 38 cents, one penny for each year of a misspent life, and the lyrics to another song. Stephen Foster loved his wife, his Jeannie with the light brown hair. But the love of his wife could not stop him from drinking, and he died in drunken convulsions. It seemed to come on him like a sickness, his wife once said, and so it does. Robert Louis Stevenson was an alcoholic. He could weave the magic of children's stories, and he all but destroyed himself with the magic that he found in a bottle. Now, it could have been a quart of gin or a fifth of bourbon. And he describes the personality change of an alcoholic in the story, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I watched that personality change right in my own living room. Many of you here today saw the same personality change. You saw the bottle change the man you love into a drunken, babbling idiot, into a degenerated animal, into a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, history says very little about the families of these men and others like them, but I believe that I know the loneliness that Jeannie knew when she waited for her restless, talented husband to come home from one of his sprees. And I believe that I know the homesickness that Fanny Stevenson knew when she went to a South Sea island with her husband in hopes that he might regain his health. Robert Louis Stevenson had a dual problem. He was also tubercular. And I believe that I know the joy that they knew when he did regain his health. And I believe that I know the serenity that they both knew when he found sobriety. Now, why do I tell you the history lessons? It's simply this. These very self-same people who, before our generation, before our lifetime, who were so incapable and unable to do anything about alcoholism are doing a great deal about it in our generation. Priests and ministers now feel that alcoholics are God's children too. And they send them to AA meetings so they can get help. And they send their families to us so they can get well too. It's now possible to get a man in a hospital for treatment on a simple diagnosis of alcoholism. This was not true only a few years ago. You could not get anyone in a hospital unless the doctor was willing to falsify the diagnosis and say something else was wrong. County judges now send alcoholics for treatment instead of sending them to jail. And we have fabulous rehabilitation programs in our federal penitentiaries under the auspices of AA. Magazines and newspapers are writing articles about alcoholism. NCA has endeavored to educate the public about alcoholism. They work on the concept that alcoholism is a treatable illness and that the alcoholic needs and deserves help. It's hard to pick up a magazine anymore and not find an article on alcoholism. It seems to me now that it's the end thing to have an alcoholic in your family. And there was a time that if you didn't have one, I'd been able to loan you one because I had plenty in my family. But these very self-same people are doing a great deal about alcoholism at the present time. But regardless of all the effort that's being made and all the money that's being spent, and you all, bless your heart, have enough treatment centers to fill a battleship. We're very blessed in West Texas. We don't have any treatment centers. But with all the effort that they're making, and please don't misunderstand me, I would not downgrade our friends in their professions. Oh, no, I would never do that. But regardless of all the effort that's being made and all the money that's being spent, they're not doing very much about alcoholism. Had you noticed? So as far as I'm concerned, this is a job for you to do. Because you're the people who know about alcoholism. You know the symptoms of alcoholism. You know about the progression of the disease. Some of the AA people in this room know about alcoholic convulsions. Some of them have lived through the terrors of DTs. You know about slips in AA. You know about the alibi system. There isn't very much about alcoholism that you do not know because you've lived with it. So in my opinion, this is a job for you to do, a job for you and for me. And I learned this a long time ago, a very long time ago. I've been involved in this program for exactly half of my lifetime, not half of my adult lifetime, half of my lifetime. I'm 68 years old, and I've been in the Al-Anon family groups for 34 of those years. And I learned that this is a job for me to do a very long time ago. And you see, I came into this outfit before we had an outfit. When I came here, there were 50 groups, 50 Al-Anon family groups in the whole world. I think it's quite significant to learn that 7 of those groups were in Texas. That tells you something about those two-fisted drinkers over there. But there was 50 groups in the whole world, and I don't know what the last count. I'll learn when I go up to the conference tomorrow afternoon. I'll learn how many groups we've got in the world now. But I think it's upward of 25,000. Is that right, Marna? And when I came here, we didn't have any literature. Not one single piece of literature did we have. We had very little in those early days. All we actually had was the awareness of a great need for help and the very dubious permission of some people who were very new in AA to come to their meeting places while they had a meeting. And so that's what we did. We came to these meeting places and we huddled around tables in dirty little alcoves or anywhere you could put a few chairs. And we talked. Now, I'm not going to have to tell you what we talked about. It was a kind of a morbid competition to see which one of us lived with the sorriest man. And I wasn't comfortable in those early groups because, you see, I do not live with a sorry man. I never did live with a sorry man. I lived with a fine young man who drank too much. Actually, these groups were nothing more or less than little gossip groups. And I love what Barbara said. I have to remind those of you who are in Al-Anon now that you would not be here today if we had not been there then. I get a little defensive about these early groups. And the dear people who wrote who started the life-changing program of Alcoholics Anonymous knew, had the vision to see that in time, the families of alcoholics would become aware of their great need for help, and so they made provisions for us. I sometimes say that Al-Anon is a kissing cousin to invention because we were both born of necessity, and the dear people who put this life-changing program together knew that we would become aware of this necessity, and they made provisions for us. Because they included in the book Alcoholics Anonymous 2 chapters for the families. One of these chapters is entitled To the Family Afterwards, and the other chapter is addressed to the wives of alcoholics. Now, this is not intended to be a put-down to the fine men who are members of Al-Anon family groups. The fact of the matter is that when this book was written, there were no women in AA, so they simply addressed this chapter to the wives. The early groups in Canada called their Al-Anon groups wives groups. We had many names in those days. We didn't have one uniform name such as we have now. Some of those names were rather ridiculous, and some of them I cannot repeat in polite society. But eventually we got one name. We call ourselves the Al-Anon family groups. Gail asked me a moment ago, she said she had only recently learned where we got the name, and it isn't a big mystery. We took the first syllable of alcoholics and we took the first syllable of anonymous and hyphenated and call ourselves Al-Anon family groups. I'm proud to inform you that the Austin group in Texas called themselves an Al-Anon family group in 1949, and Al-Anon was not officially formed until 1951. I do not tell the people in New York that we named the groups, but you can draw your own conclusion. I don't tell the people in New York a lot of things. No, I'm kidding. But the fact of the matter is that these chapters were what we started with. That's how we started. At one time, and before the conferences were started, it was possible to get a booklet from the World Service Office that included these two chapters in booklet form. I still have some of those in my files. They're no longer on the conference approved list. There are those people who say the big book is not conference approved, and I'm sorry to have to tell you that it is. It's approved by the AA General Service Conferences, which predates ours by 10 years. So it is a conference approved publication. But down in our part of Texas, down in my part of the country, we took a paragraph out of the chapter to the family afterwards, and we made a little preamble of it that we used to open our meetings. And this is what the paragraph says. The past is the principal asset of the families of alcoholics, and frequently it is almost the only one. This painful past can be of infinite value to families still struggling with their problem. We feel that each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not, and when the occasion requires, every member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others how we were given help is the only thing that makes our life worthwhile. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, your dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death or misery for them. Now, as Barbara told you, I saw the beginning of the All-Non Family Group literature. It was written with the understanding that you had first read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and was intended to be a supplement, not a substitute. And I don't have any idea how many pieces of literature that we have at the present time. I haven't served as a secretary of a group for a long time because I think this is a channel of rotation that belongs to those of you who are coming in now, not for those of us who've grown white-haired in the service. I have no idea how many pieces of literature, but I say this to you in all sincerity. As far as I'm concerned, we do not have one single piece of literature that more clearly points out to me what my responsibility is to families of alcoholics. Nor do we have one single piece of literature that more clearly points out to me how I can show my gratitude for the sobriety in my home and for the good things that sobriety has brought to us. And I deplore the fact that this thing has come up that we should not use the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I deplore this. I think it's deplorable. And I get into trouble every time I lean on one of these podiums because I report the fact that anybody I sponsor, now remember I said anybody I sponsor, that is not inclusive. It doesn't mean the rest of you. If you all want to stay sick, why, be my guest. But anybody I sponsor, I require them to first read the first 164 pages of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, so they will know the nature of the illness that destroyed their lives. These 164 pages include the philosophy of the program that we're trying to use to change our lives. And without it, you're starting with a strike against you. And there are those that say that we shouldn't read it. Well, don't if you want to stay sick. But if you want to get well, for God's sake, learn what you're trying to use to change your life. And you will find it in the world's foremost authority on alcoholism, which is called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't emphasize that too much. And I have a good criterion to base my emphatic comments on. The people I sponsor get well. The people I sponsor get well. And this is a requirement. You may not know, and I'm happy to report to you, that in the 1971 conference, and that date may not be accurate, I'm not a date person, but it's when I first served on your board of trustees, and California particularly was giving the board a great deal of hassle about developing a 12 Steps and 12 Traditions book for Al-Anon. You may not also know that the first 10 World Service Conferences were opened by a gentleman called Bill Wilson. And the first year I served on the board, he was having difficulty. He had emphysema, as you recall, and he was pretty breathless that morning, and he could not open the conference. But he was in the hotel. Alice Butler was chairman of the literature committee at that time, and because of these increasing requests from California and other places, she was debating about whether or not she should write a 12 Steps and 12 Traditions book for Al-Anon. Alice was a very fabulous, wonderful journalist. She wrote the biography of J.C. Penney. She knew him and worked for him for many years. And she went to Bill's room to tell him about this assignment, and he said to her, "Why do you need a 12 Steps and 12 Traditions book for Al-Anon? Why don't you use what we already have?" He said, "I did not write the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions book just for alcoholics. This is a philosophy of living that applies to all people. Why don't you use what you have?" And Alice came back to the conference floor and made this report. And the World Service Conference members, including the delegates, the Board of Trustees, and the World Service Office staff, stood on their feet and voted unanimously to use the AA 12 and 12 for in-depth step study meetings. At that time, the AA people were generous enough and gracious enough till they published a small edition of the AA 12 and 12 that is listed on their price list as a gift size book. And if you will put it side by side with your Al-Anon one day at a time, you will discover that it makes a perfectly matched pair. Compliments from the AA people. If you want to verify this, I can document it. Talk to Theresa Lomax. She was there in that conference. And I think in one of your little newsletters, she goes back and digs up historical facts for you. And I think she reprinted this information on one occasion. But it can be documented. So people, I sponsor first study the first 164 pages of the big book. And when they're ready to dig into the steps, we pick up Bill Wilson's AA 12 and 12. If you have not read the most recent book about Bill Wilson's life called Pass It On, you will discover that at the time that he wrote the AA 12 and 12, he was battling deep depressions. And I think that's why it applies to us so very much. I think it went far beyond his alcoholism and dealt with feelings that all of us who love alcoholics can identify with. And this is very important to me. I hope it's very important to you. In Al-Anon, we simply say we share with you our experience, strength, and hope in love. And that's what I came over here to do. Bill is terribly disappointed. He was invited to come too. And after this invitation from the World Service Office came that I should come up and join in this conference that they're calling the 25th Al-Anon World Service Conference, and I think it's the 24th, Bill decided to stay behind and let me do this by myself. But he wants you to know that he appreciated the invitation, and he's very sorry not to be here with you this weekend. I once said, and Barbara overheard me, that when you invite me alone, that you only get the second team. Bill's the first team in our family. Bill's a dear man, and you all would love him, I know. We share with you our experience, strength, and hope, and most certainly I do this with love. I attended my first AA meeting in Amarillo, Texas in 1948. I didn't want to go to that meeting. My Bill learned about Alcoholics Anonymous in 1945, but he did not find sobriety until 1951. And in those intervening years, I did not have very much confidence in my young husband's sobriety. I didn't know much about alcoholics, and I could not see any constructive purpose to be served in associating myself with a whole group of them when I was having so much trouble with one of them. So I didn't want to go to that meeting. And the only reason that I went to that meeting was because I had put myself under obligation to a very lovely woman who was married to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she had invited me to the meeting. Now, you may have discovered by now that I'm not a Texan. I'm a hillbilly. I grew up in the hills of North Carolina, and hillbillies do not like to be obliged to anybody. And so I went to the meeting simply because I was under obligation to Marguerite. It was a large meeting. About 100 people were there, an open meeting. And I drink a lot of coffee, as you have noticed. And I'm sure I'd made several trips to the coffee bar. And after we were seated in the meeting, a very lovely woman that I later learned was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous leaned across Marguerite and whispered to me. And what she said was, "How long has it been since you had a drink, honey?" So you see, I didn't get here in such a great shape. Elsa Chamberlain, who grew up in Al-Anon on the West Coast, described me long before she ever met me. She talked about people who came to her meetings out in California. She said they got there just 2 jumps ahead of a fit. And that's how I got here, just 2 jumps ahead of a fit. But I was not embarrassed by the woman's question, because you see, I'm not a teetotaler. I used to say that I did not trust teetotalers. But I have a friend in Al-Anon who never tasted whiskey in her life. She really is a teetotaler, and I would trust Mildred with my life, so I don't say that anymore. But Marguerite was terribly embarrassed by the woman's question, and she answered the question for me. She said, "Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism." You see, I grew up in a house with 2 men, both of whom was my father. My father was a two-fisted construction man. He worked hard, he played hard, and he drank hard. My dad was a gray-eyed Irishman who taught me to love poetry, who taught me to sing Irish folk songs. That's where I get this crazy name. He had the patience to teach me to work my geometry problems with his framing square. But on Saturday night, he turned into a devil. My father's alcoholism destroyed both my parents. My father's alcoholism turned my lovely mother into an old, ugly, bitter woman who hated my dad. She hated him as long as she lived. She hated him long after he was dead and in his grave. And in the last years of her life, which she spent in total darkness, she hated anybody that had ever loved John Martin, and that included me. My father was a craftsman, the likes of which they don't make anymore. Dad loved wood. I've watched Dad caress a piece of wood, much the same as a lady caresses a piece of velvet or a piece of satin. And he would say of the wood as he caressed it, "It has a beautiful fault." And I didn't know what Dad was talking about until I got into this program. Dad loved to build things for Mother. I've seen him in the winter months literally spend months building something for Mother, a china closet, a table. He would select the wood very carefully. He would put it together with great precision, as only a craftsman can do. He would sand it and polish it and make of it truly a thing of beauty. And then he would smash it in a drunken fury. I long since lost account of how many sets of china that Dad bought for Mother. He loved to throw things. He loved the sound of breaking glass for some reason. Dad didn't just destroy bars. He destroyed whole communities. He'd break every plate glass window in town in a drunken spree on Saturday night. And then he would send his crew out Monday morning to put the glass back in again. My dad was one of those people who never found this program. He used to come to Texas, and he'd go to AA meetings with Bill and me. And when we'd come home from those meetings, he would say to us, "How do you get the want to, Bill? How do you get the want to?" Dad never found the want to, and he couldn't stay sober. And for many years, after I found the courage in this program to ask God for special favors, I used to close every day of my life with one special prayer. God, don't let my dad die drunk. Now, I cannot tell you why this is such a terror to those of us who love alcoholics. I can only tell you that it is. God, don't let my dad die drunk. My father died in 1965 of throat cancer. He did not die drunk. And when my brother Mike called me to tell me that Dad had been diagnosed as having a terminal illness, we were living in Austin, Texas at that time, and he said to me, "Sis, we're going to have to pray extra hard. Dad isn't going to make it." And I said, "No, no." You see, God answered my prayer. Now, you know that I didn't want that filthy stuff to destroy that beautiful baritone voice. You know I didn't want that filthy stuff to make it impossible for him to even swallow. You know I didn't. I simply prayed, "God, don't let my dad die drunk." Now, I do not tell you these things about my dad or about my mother that you may weep for them. My dad's all right. My dad doesn't have to drink anymore. And mother doesn't hate him anymore. I tell you these things about my dad and about my mother that you may know that I have always loved an alcoholic. And because I love alcoholics, I want to restore their families. I know about alcoholics. I know that of all the things an alcoholic loves, he loves his family most. Even when he tears us down over and over and over again, he loves his family most. Of this I am convinced. Of this I am convinced. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. And I want you to know that when I met this tall Texan that is the father of our children, I wasn't concerned with Bill's drinking. Father Joe Martin says that the only way that you can identify an alcoholic is by the alcoholic that you know. And Bill didn't drink like my dad did. My dad was a hallucinating, violent drunk who saw creeping, crawling things. And he hurt my mother. He hurt my mother physically and emotionally. And mother never could quite understand, and I'm quite sure I could not have either, that when her jaw was broken, that dad had not meant to hurt her. He had only intended to kill a centipede that was crawling in her hair. And I'm sure this would be hard for me to understand. And Bill didn't drink like that. Bill was a happy drunk. He crashed debutante's party and taught the do-waggers to do the put your little foot and the Texas stomp. And he didn't drink like Dad. And so I wasn't concerned. I drank with Bill. We work for an advertising company that sent us all over this country. And we've been awfully drunk in New Orleans. I don't recall ever being drunk in Baton Rouge, but oh, law, New Orleans was something else. We got drunk in St. Louis, Kalamazoo, Chicago. Anywhere we went, we got drunk. And in my generation, it seemed very important that you have fun. And I heard an AA lady say one time that she had so much fun, it liked to kill her. All the people that we worked with were about the same age as we were, and we had fun. But in 1940, two things happened that should have made Bill and me grow up. We became parents, and the world became involved in a war, and I quit drinking with Bill. Things were too serious. My brothers were in service, and members of Bill's family were too, and I was watching casualty lists and reports of battles overseas, and I didn't drink with Bill anymore. The next year, we had our second daughter, and Bill was not there when Nancy arrived. Nancy came on Wednesday, and she didn't meet her father till the next Sunday. And when Bill came to the hospital with the usual paraphernalia that men bring to their wives when we go to delivery rooms, he caused a great deal of confusion in this Catholic hospital in Cincinnati, Ohio. And who was in charge of the maternity ward, the Texas stomp, and the good sister didn't want to dance. And he caused, they evicted him, of course. Two big burly orderlies carried him out of the room. And he sat down on the streetcar track in full view of my window and forced the motorman to stop so he could tell him about our new baby girl. You see, Bill was still having fun with his drinking. The next year we had our only son, and I couldn't talk about this for a long time behind podiums like this because I manipulated this pregnancy. I knew that Bill wanted a son. I guess every man does. But something went wrong in the delivery room when our son came. And they needed Bill, and they couldn't find Bill. Now, had I been able to talk to them, or had they asked me, I could have told them that they'd find Bill in a bar. But you see, I didn't know which one. And my good friends in AA tell me there is no loneliness in the world as great as that of the alcoholic who has run out of time. But I believe I know about loneliness. The loneliness of an alcoholic's wife when she goes to a delivery room with the full knowledge that a compulsion to drink is depriving her of her husband's devotion. This, I believe, is loneliness. The lonely task of keeping the spirit of Christmas alive or putting together Easter baskets for small children whose father has forgotten what day it is. This, I believe, is loneliness. And the lonely task of waiting by the hospital bed of an injured child who cries for her daddy. I want my daddy. And you can't find her daddy. This, I believe, is loneliness. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. They told us that our little boy would never walk. I well remember the Polish doctor who put Luther in my lap when I was in a wheelchair leaving the hospital, and she said to me, take him home, Mrs. O'Neill, and enjoy him, because you can't keep him. 6 weeks later, when I took him back for a checkup, he had not gained weight, he had lost weight. And he had to go through a series of X-ray treatments to reduce a little growth that was in his throat. In this interim, with all the special medicines and the specialists that we were gratefully able to afford at that time, he developed rickets. And you all in this part of the country know about rickets. It happens to sorry, low-down, white, trashy people. Not to people like Bill and me. And they told me my son would never walk. When Luther was 3 months old, I discovered I was pregnant again. But I started this trek to crippled children's hospitals, the length and breadth of our country, to try to find a specialist that make my boy walk. It became an obsession with me. Very fortunately for Teresa, she's one of those kind of people who thrives on loving neglect. And that was good because that's all she got. Because I was busy going to yet another specialist, to another crippled children's hospital, to find somebody who would make my son walk. And I rejoice to this moment, just thinking about it, to remember the time when he was 3 years old when he took his first step. With the therapy he had and the specialist that we found for him, Luther is one of those unique people who has perfect coordination. He has his own business now, and He writes his payroll checks with his left hand, which is natural for him, and he writes his own salary checks with his right hand so he can stay honest. And I get a lump in my throat when I see him run across a parking lot to jump a fence because this was a little boy who wasn't supposed to walk. And I want you also to know that when I came to Texas in 1944 it was, that I had never heard the term alcoholism in reference to my young husband's drinking. Not one single time had I ever heard this reference. And I don't know why I didn't, because I read everything, including cereal boxes, but I had never heard the term alcoholism in reference to my young husband's drinking. And I watched alcoholism take away from my Bill everything that he wanted to keep. My Bill lost his left eye in a drunken accident. And he couldn't quit drinking. My Bill lost his left arm in a drunken accident, and he couldn't stop drinking. I watched him lose his self-respect, the affection of his family. I watched him lose everything that he had that he wanted to keep, and he could not stop drinking. And I watched this happen, and I wanted to help him. With every fiber of my being, I wanted to help him. And I want to say something to those of you who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous at this point, and please believe me, I would never intentionally say anything from this or any other podium that would hurt you. Good God knows you've been hurt enough. But I've heard members of Alcoholics Anonymous stand at podiums like this around the country and have the unmitigated gall and the asinine arrogance to say a non-alcoholic don't know what they're talking about. And I want you to know that I know what I'm talking about. I wanted to help Bill. We all wanted to help you, but you wouldn't let us. It seemed to me that you put us on the other side of a thick glass wall, and we could see you, and we could hear you. We're not callous, insensitive people. We know the mental anguish that you endure. We know the physical torture, but we can't get through to you because you won't let us. The feeling I'm trying to describe is the same feeling that you have when you tend a sick child. You know, the baby's bringing up a fever and it cries, and you want to help the baby, but you can't because the baby can't tell you where it hurts. And the alcoholic couldn't tell us where they hurt, and we couldn't help you, but we wanted to. And the next time that you feel that you want to indict the families of alcoholics, will you please remember what I said? We wanted to help you, but we couldn't help you because you wouldn't let us. And there's many, many people in Alcoholics Anonymous walking the face of this good green earth in good health and in sobriety simply because somebody like me cared enough to stay around. And I hope they never forget that. I know my Bill will never forget it. He thinks Al-Anon is the greatest thing, as Bill Wilson did, that's ever happened since Alcoholics Anonymous began. And it was because of this unholy compulsion that started Bill and me on what I call a new kind of education. Now, in the pursuit of this education, we learned many things and we met many people. The first people, of course, that we met were the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never shall forget the AA member that first talked to me. He came to my house in the middle of the afternoon and he described to me what I referred to then, not knowing any other way to describe it. He described what I referred to as this rehabilitation program for people who have alcoholism. And after about 2.5 hours, I asked him a question. I said, "What do you have in this rehabilitation program of yours for the wives and children of alcoholics?" And he couldn't answer my question. I don't think anyone had ever asked him that before. And he said to me, We don't have anything for the wives and children of Mrs. O'Neill. You do not have a problem. Dear God. At that moment, I could not wear sleeves on my arms because of a rash that the doctor said was caused by nerves. I was so nervous that I couldn't stand in my own shoes. And this good AA member said to me, "You do not have a problem." I thought he was wrong. I still think he was wrong. And I believe with all my heart that it was that selfsame cold, dreary, rainy November afternoon when I stood in the living room of a mean little rent house in Brownwood, Texas, where we live now, that I made up my mind that someday, someday, somehow, I would find a way to help the families of alcoholics. And by the grace of God, that opportunity came to me because, you see, I met some more people. I met a strange group of non-alcoholic folk who found it vitally necessary to live by the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous to restore their sanity and to preserve their stability. These people developed the same self-pity as does the alcoholic. These people nourish the same resentments as does the alcoholic. These people develop the same personality traits as does the alcoholic. There was only one difference. These people did not have the allergy to booze, and this was the most revolting development of all, because this meant that we had to take our punishment standing up, cold sober. And there's not an alcoholic in the world can do it, not without help. Some of these people seem to have been born with an understanding heart, and the rest of these people seem to have developed the understanding because they had lived with a serious illness and sometimes with tragedy. And I knew these people. I was drawn to them. As I said, they didn't have they had a lot of names, but they didn't have a uniform name at that time. In time, of course, they were to be called Al-Anon family groups. These people could give me the courage to face life one day at a time. And they could give me courage just because they were there. And when I came to these people, I was totally and utterly destitute. Now, I know that's a much misused term, but it's the only one I can come up with. I was totally and utterly destitute. I had no faith in God. I had no confidence in my husband's sobriety. I couldn't trust people. Oh, I knew there was a God, with the definition that an agnostic is one who does not know God. I was agnostic. I knew there was a creator of the universe, if you please. I thought that he changed the seasons. I thought he changed the days into nights, and I thought he hung up the stars to make it pretty for us. I even thought he put people here, and then he let us go to hell backward. But I had absolutely no concept of a personal contact with God, none at all. None at all. Oh, I know now that I tried to pray when I was scared and cold and sometimes hungry. And I know now, of course, that God heard me. I believe that God listens very carefully to the prayers of the beginners and the prayers of the alcoholic, because he knows that we do not have the words that prayers are made of, and so he listens very carefully. And he heard me. He heard me when all I could say was, "Oh God, oh God." And he knew why I couldn't trust people. People do not deal very kindly with families of alcoholics. And he knew why I couldn't trust people. This had been ground out of me in the experiences that I'd had. And I never thought I didn't think there was any justice in it. I can recall not having my school contract renewed because my husband drank too much. And that wasn't fair. I was a good teacher. I can remember going to welfare agencies at the lowest point of Bill's drinking, when he had a broken leg because he had confronted his boss with the wrong attitude. And we were evicted from a rent house in Knoxville, Tennessee that rented for $50 a month when Bill was bringing home $500 or $600 a month and rent a week in commissions when he worked for Holland Furnace Company. And I could see the look of pity and disgust on the faces of those who served those eviction notices. And it took a long, long time for me to get over my resentment of social workers. I well remember going to a welfare agency, and I don't think my friends in Texas quite understand this. I don't think they'll ever know the degradation and the humiliation that a hillbilly can feel when they have to ask for charity. I don't think they'll ever understand it. But you'll do it. You'll go to a welfare agency to feed your children. Don't think you won't. You'll go to a welfare agency to get help for your young son. You will. And I well remember the look of pity and disgust on that young woman's face when she wrote on my application blank in bold black letters as if I couldn't read, "Husband is a drunkard." This is the kind of treatment that was handed out to families of alcoholics before there was so much information and so much education. And God knew why I couldn't trust people. God knew I couldn't even trust myself. I was not responsible for what I said, and I was not responsible for what I did. I thoroughly agree with Reverend Kellerman, who says that the reaction of those who love alcoholics to the drinking is as compulsive as the drinking is to the alcoholic. I believe that with all my heart, and I was not responsible. And God knew this. And I also want to make one other fact crystal clear. I did not come to the family groups, which is what we called our meetings in Texas, before Al-Anon came into existence. I did not go to the family group meetings to get my husband sober. I want to make that crystal clear. I was scared to death. I was not honest enough to say I was fearful of my mental condition. I said I was concerned with my emotional stability. That sounds a little better. But I was scared to death that I was losing my mind. And in the late 40s, they were writing a lot of articles in ladies' magazines about something they call group therapy and mental health. And so I went to the family group meetings thinking that this is what they were. And in a sense, that's what they are, very fine therapy. And I went there primarily because my husband was ashamed of me and because our children were afraid of me. And I didn't want my Bill to be ashamed of me. And I did not want my children to be afraid of me. And God knows they had every right to be afraid of me. I punished my children unmercifully if they spilled a glass of milk on a white tablecloth. And I insisted on white tablecloths. I never had the courage to ask a psychologist about this, but it doesn't really make any sense to me that you'd try to prove to your own children that you were an aristocrat, but I did it. I punished them unmercifully if they made a C on their grade cards because I would not tolerate failure. I would say to them, anybody can be average. And they were afraid to bring home their grade cards if they made a C. And as I told you, Bill was ashamed of me, and he had every right to be. And that's why I went to the family group meetings. And they told me in those meetings that if I would put the principles of this program to work in my life, that my life would change. And dear God, that's what I wanted. I wanted my life to change. And so I did exactly what they told me to do. I started to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started with step one and worked right down through step 12. I hear people talking now about working up the steps, and I wonder where on earth they're going. Bill Wilson says you work down the steps, and hopefully there you will find peace of mind and serenity. And so I worked down the steps. And I'd like to be able to tell you that overnight I became a wise and wonderful woman, and that obviously is not the truth. But I will tell you that my life changed. The first thing that I could notice, of course, was that my children were no longer afraid of me. They got so brave that they'd even sass me. Now, they prefaced these little smart aleck remarks by saying, "Now, Mother, I know I'm sassing, but..." And that took a lot of courage for that little bunch of people. And then a little later, I became aware of the fact that once again, Bill was proud of me. And this is very important to those of us who love alcoholics. I described to you earlier what an alcoholic is. They're about as low down as you can get on our social totem pole. And then the alcoholics rejected us. So this sick need for approval is a very real thing in our recovery. And all of us have it to some degree or other. And the approval, of course, is from one particular alcoholic. And we don't get that very often or get very much. And we don't need very much. We just need them occasionally to say, "You did a good job," or "You look nice," or "You smell good." That'll do. But this sick need for approval is a very real part of our recovery. And I was grateful that once again Bill was proud of me. But the most important part of my recovery at that point in time was the fact that I belonged to something. You see, I'd never belonged to anything in my life. As I told you, I grew up in construction camps around this country. One of my friends in Dallas asked me one time how I ever got an education. I didn't remember to tell her that my dad was the boss and that we had tutors in the camps. But I never belonged anywhere. I used to walk along picket fence and small communities and run a stick along the picket fence and hear it clatter and look through the lighted windows and see the people having their dinners and wish I was home again in North Carolina. I didn't have friends over to stay nights with me. I didn't belong anywhere. I didn't go to one school more than one semester till I was high school age. Didn't belong anywhere. You don't go to church if you don't believe in God, so I didn't belong to a church. But now I belong to the most wonderful thing in the world. I belong to the Al-Anon family groups. And you may have discovered by now that there's a little difference in Al-Anon family group members and AA members. Did you notice there's a little difference? You see, there's no quitters in Al-Anon. Do you know that? There's no quitters in Al-Anon. I don't know what happens to them, bless their heart, but they don't stay in Al-Anon. There's no quitters. We don't know how to quit. We never quit hoping that the man we love will come home again. Sometimes they take long detours and get bogged down in bottles. And we never quit hoping that they'll come home again. Hope burns low at times, but we never quit hoping. And we never quit helping the alcoholic. Now our methods get a little drastic, but we never quit helping the alcoholic. But more important than either of those, we never quit loving the alcoholic. And dear God, we did not know that love was not enough. And when these psychologists and other people put labels on us, those crummy names like Suffering Susie and Faltering Francis and all those goodies, and when they got a little bit more educated, they call us disturbing factors and aggravating influences. Shoot. Those people didn't know that we did not know that love was not enough. And they were not aware of the fact that we tried to solve a problem that had totally and utterly, completely baffled the finest minds in the clergy, in medicine, even in the legislature, or a combination of all three of them. We tried to solve that problem, and all we had going for us was that we loved an alcoholic, and we did not know that that was not enough. And I was grateful to learn these things. Very, very grateful indeed. And to be a part of something. Some of you know that I was the only delegate to the World Service Conference that Texas ever had. After I rotated out of that position, they divided our area into two areas, and now we have East and West Texas assemblies. But I'm the only Texas delegate they'll ever have, and that's kind of funny because I'm not a Texan. That caused some problems too, which is another story. I was 10 years in a program when I was privileged to go to my first World Service Conference. And when I went there, I met people from other parts of the country. And I became aware that I belonged to the whole world, that I had friends and supporters in the whole world. And some of you told me that you liked me, and then I could belong to the human race. and this was exceedingly important to me. When I was 20 years in the program, you all were gracious enough and kind enough to allow me to serve on our Board of Trustees. And so I went back again to the World Service Conferences and saw the remarkable changes that had happened in the intervening panels since I had been away. And I got to the wonderful opportunity of meeting Bill Wilson and talking with him and working very closely with Lois. I will never, I hope I never get old enough or senile enough or foolish enough to say I'm a close personal friend of Lois Wilson, because that is not true. Our backgrounds are poles apart. But I believe that Lois has, that we have mutual affection and respect for each other. And I'm just thrilled to death at the opportunity of being able to get to see her this weekend. And all of these things were exceedingly important to me. But you told me in the very beginning that the only way I could keep these things was to give them away. And I've made a king-size effort to do that. I've tried with all my might and main to give this program away. And I used the principles of this program to rear those four children of ours. And I know now, and this is only in retrospect, I know now that this deep burning urgency within me that made me have to know all there is to know about structure and about the principles of this program, it was a deep burning urgency within me that left me no peace. I know now that the underlying motive of that urgency was to protect my children. You know, all of us who are mothers have a big, wide streak of tiger right down our backbone. When you threaten our children, we come out fighting. And I was going to learn everything I could about this dastardly stuff and protect our children. That was my underlying motivation. At that time, I could not have told you this. I would have fancied it up some other way. And you all made me much better than I am. You called me dedicated and all of those good things. But the underlying motivation was to take care of those children, to stop this damn stuff in this generation. Wipe it out. That didn't happen. I think when I was in Lafayette, that's the last time I think I was over here, I stood behind a podium much like this and I told you that I'd put those four kids of mine up with any four in the world. And I recited their degrees and accomplishments with great pride and arrogance. And then I had to eat my words. Because you see, alcoholism wasn't through with the O'Neills. I began to hear strange reports out of Austin, Texas, where my husband was living with his wife and two small boys. I began to hear AA people say, Luther spends more time in bars than he spends in his office. And I waited. I'd been in Al-Anon long enough to wait. I didn't snatch him up and say, get yourself off to an AA meeting or I'm gonna break every bone in your body. I knew better. I waited. Sometimes they'd call me and say, you can go to sleep now, Arbutus. I followed Luther home and he turned in his own driveway. But Luther had to find sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. Luther has been in the program for 5 years, but he's only been sober for 3 of those years. He had to experiment a little bit better, a little more before he was through. And if you think it is difficult to quiet and still the reactions to the nature of this illness in someone you're married to, you know how that is. You know how it hurts and drives the reason for living out of your very being. You know about that. But I want you to know when it's your only son, that this other feeling is a piece of cake. And that even doesn't compare with the anguish and the feelings that you have to stifle and resolve when the reports start coming into you that your beautiful daughter keeps a martini on the sideboard while she involves herself with gourmet cooking. When you hear reports that she acted in a way that was not very nice at the country club dance. When you learn that the police take her home instead of taking her to jail because she's too drunk to drive her car and then she's dressed only in her favorite nightgown. these are the things, because I have a good imagination, and alcoholics have no defense against our imagination, none at all. And I'd heard AA ladies tell the price they paid for the drinking they did. And this almost drove me out of my mind. But again, because of Al-Anon, I did not interfere. And Nancy had to flee the country and live in Mexico for a few years after the breakup of her first marriage. But she's sober in AA now for 3 years, and she remarried last month a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe with all my heart that God has some real nice things in store for Nancy, because God knows she's had enough of the other kind. But I didn't know those things then. You simply told me to practice these principles in all my affairs, and that's what I tried to do. And I learned a lot, of course. You can't stay around wonderful people like you for 34 years and not learn anything, if you have any sense at all. And I've learned a great deal about feelings and about the little computer that Al-Anon provides for us. And I've learned that anything that happens in my life, that I've got a beautiful little computer at my hand. And I put everything that I do through my little computer. If it's a fact, I learn to accept it. And if it's a feeling, I know how to change it. And you can do this even when alcoholism threatens the lives of your children. I know not what the motivation or the intent or the reason behind the fact that I've lived with alcoholism for 3 generations. I do not understand that, and I don't have to understand that. I only accept it. But I've talked far too long. I get compulsive when I'm tired, and I've had a rough spring season. Not unhappy, but busy. And I came in tired, and I'm not quite rested yet, and I get very compulsive when I'm tired. I guess I'm compulsive when I'm not tired. But I want to close the way I always close, and I want you to listen to me very carefully. I want to say to you that we are the only people in this world who are so uniquely qualified to carry the message of this program. We're the only people who have that unique qualifications, and this is our responsibility. And I want you to know, and I know you do, that within a stone's throw of this beautiful hotel, right here in the capital city of Louisiana, that there are drunken men and women this minute who will die in ignorance, never knowing they're alcoholic, if we fail to carry the message of this program. And there's men and women within a stone's throw of this beautiful hotel, or in any town that you want to recall, who will not have the courage to face life one more day with an alcoholic, and they'll break up their homes if we fail to carry the message of this program. And the kids. This is Saturday afternoon, and hundreds and thousands of kids all over this world are this moment trembling with fear, dreading for their dad to come home, or maybe it's their mother, dreading for them to come home. Because Saturdays are the worst of all, remember? And these kids will grow up with deformed personalities if we fail to carry this message. And if we fail to carry this message, may God have mercy on these people. And may God have mercy on us.